This is the Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today, the Board of Directors for the Spokane Regional Health District is considering a resolution related to smoking and vaping. The measure asks the Washington legislature to raise the minimum age for buying and selling tobacco and vaping products from 18 to 21. It also encourages other local governments, businesses, and nonprofit agencies to adopt similar resolutions. The county's health officer, Dr. Bob Lutz, says other cities and states around the nation have passed similar resolutions.
Cities, countries, I mean, California, Oregon, but I'm looking at the map here, and we see it in communities like Colorado, Kansas, Arkansas, Mississippi, all states that have actually passed either local or citywide resolutions about raising the age of tobacco to the age of 21.
And what's the benefit?
Well, the benefit, I would argue, is essentially at least twofold. First of all, we have to really look at the fact that although much is focused on individuals 18 and over, the reality is that at some level we're really trying to affect tobacco initiation practices of younger people. You know, so the statistics indicate that 96% of individuals initiate tobacco usage before the age of 21 and 88% before the age of 18. You look at the fact that right now it's estimated that 480,000 individuals die prematurely of tobacco-related illnesses, and 40 million individuals smoke. So if you can positively impact youth and prevent them from initiating smoking, then all the data suggests that the likelihood of them taking up tobacco products after the age of 21 is limited significantly. Something that needs to be understood is that we know right now that students or young people under the age of 18 can't purchase tobacco. We've done a lot to restrict their access. But what we're concerned about is what's called social sourcing. So the reality is that the majority of youth who are smoking right now are getting tobacco from those peers, those high school classmates, those older sibs who are 18 plus.
It's kind of a black market.
Yeah, it's estimated that two-thirds of youth who are smoking are getting their cigarettes from older adolescents, teenagers. And so, yes, so much of the focus in the criticism of the legislation is that we're telling young people who can vote, can marry, can enlist, that they can't smoke. I will argue that a significant piece of this legislation is focusing on those youth under the age of 18. Now, that said, we also want to positively impact those individuals between the ages of 18 and 20. And again, the research has suggested while there are, yes, they are able to make decisions and they are able to, again, have the same cognitive capacity as adults, the reality is that their decision-making is not the same. And all the studies in behavioral science and the neuroscience suggest that, yes, they may be able to make decisions, but they are more susceptible to issues around impulse control, to persuasion by peers. And so again, although looked upon as paternalistic, I would argue from a public health standpoint that if I can prevent those individuals from going the direction of taking an adverse, unhealthy behavior, because maybe they're not thinking all the way through, then I think that's the right thing to do.
Is this something the legislature's taken up in the past? And obviously it hasn't passed yet. But
yeah, they've looked at it. And again, the issue oftentimes is, again, as I mentioned to you previously, about telling someone being paternalistic, but there's also concerns about revenue loss. I mean, unfortunately, it does come down to there's money being made. And this is a significant revenue stream. So if I bump up the age to 21, then it's been argued that we're losing a revenue stream, not only for the state taxes, but also for the retailer. Because again, that's a very interesting population that are using tobacco products quite extensively. So again, there's a money, economics piece in there that's been why it's been successfully sort of pushed back in the past.
It's Dr. Bob Lutz, the Spokane County Health Officer. The County Board of Health is voting on the smoking and vaping resolution this afternoon. In the states that have allowed legalized marijuana, Washington is the only one that doesn't allow recreational users the freedom to grow their own cannabis. And now the Liquor and Cannabis Control Board is offering the legislature some home grow options. Steve Jackson talks about that with Brian Smith, a spokesman for the Liquor and Cannabis Board.
The board is presenting the legislature with three different options related to marijuana home grows. Could you outline those for us?
Right. The 2017 legislature directed the Liquor and Cannabis Board to study and make recommendations back to it by December 1st of 2018 on recreational home grows of marijuana, which would take place, of course, in the home. And so the Liquor and Cannabis Board spent the interim reaching out to a number of stakeholder groups, whether that's cities and counties, law enforcement. We held a public hearing. Met with the prevention community and others to gather input, and in the end, we came back with three recommendations. And one of the key things that the legislature had required of us is that whatever recommendations you bring back, ensure that they're aligned with the Department of Justice's Cole memo, which lays out the enforcement priorities of the federal government when it comes to states that have legalized marijuana in some form. And so with that in mind, the board discarded a lot of options that it could have considered and stayed with three recommendations that are consistent with that Cole memo. And the first one is a tightly regulated home grow system where you would have up to four plants. Those plants would have to be loaded into the state's seed-to-sale traceability system. The state and local government would maintain enforcement priorities over that. The second option is sort of an opt-in by local governments, where if a community wanted to be able to have home grows, they could have a permitted system where you would have a permit to be able to grow up to four plants at home. And without that permit, you would not be able to. So cities and counties would have that option of whether they wanted to be a part of a system that allows that or not. And the third is continue to have no home grows at all. So that's essentially the status quo.
Do you remember what some of the other options were that didn't really fit what they thought would fall under the guidelines of the Cole Memorandum?
Well, certainly what we heard from many people at the public hearing was that we don't want to have any sort of regulation at all. You know, allow us to have as many plants as we'd like, and we don't want it to be essentially regulated. And in other states, there are regulations around home grows, but certainly what we've heard from other states is that they've had some issues, and they said if you're going to have home grows, be very conservative and keep the plants down to a minimum. For example, in Colorado, they had 99 plants originally, which was the plan, and that was a major problem for them, and they had to scale back all the way back to, I think, 12 plants, which is what I think that they have now. But it's hard to put the genie back in the bottle once you do that. And so if Washington is going to go forward, what we recommended to the legislature is you start off very conservative.
And the Cole memo, I mean, was it kind of basically just stating you really have to have strict guidelines? Or what kind of wording was in there that made you just go for these three options?
Because there's eight enforcement priorities that they list out that explain what they are. But those eight bullets can pretty much broke down into three categories: preventing diversion, which is taking product outside of the system, preventing youth access, preventing, of course, kids from having access to marijuana, and three, keeping the criminal element out of the system. And so when it comes to recreational home grows, certainly what we heard from Colorado was that they were having a problem potentially with diversion from the home grow side of things.
And then so what's the next step? I mean, it's been presented to the legislature. Do we have any idea what their plans are? Will they actively take this up, or is it up to certain lawmakers to move forward with it, or what's going to happen?
Yeah, it's the committee that oversees the liquor board and generally marijuana stuff that would likely take it up, and it's up to them. What I would imagine will happen is at some point there will be a hearing early on, and we would probably come in and present our findings and answer questions and things like that, and then they would decide how they want to be able to go. Whether something like this would be part of its own bill or part of a larger bill, it's unknown.
That's Spokane Public Radio's Steve Jackson with Brian Smith, who's a spokesman for the Washington Liquor and Cannabis Board. And the board is scheduled to present its options to the legislature next month. For years, students who wanted to go to medical school in Washington and Idaho had only one choice, and that was the University of Washington's WAMI program, which serves Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho. Now they have four choices. They include a private medical school in Yakima that opened in 2008, the new Washington State University College of Medicine, which opened in the fall, and now Idaho's first medical school has received permission to begin recruiting students. The Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine expects its first class will begin in the fall of 2018. It's a private school affiliated with Idaho State University and will operate on the university's campus in Meridian. And here to talk about that is the college's new founding dean and chief academic officer, Dr. Robert Hasty. What did you have to do in order to show the accrediting agency that you're ready for medical students?
A number of different things, Doug. Number one, we had to ensure that we were going to have the facilities ready for the students. Number two is we had to make sure that we had the faculty all lined up. And then, of course, you know, making sure that we've advanced our curriculum so that we're going to be ready for next year.
What do you have in terms of facilities? Where are your students going to do their clinical work?
So our base of operations will be out of Meridian, Idaho, about 14 minutes from downtown Boise. 94,000 square foot facility, $34 million. We're in the process of construction, and the building is about 3 weeks ahead of schedule. Will be a guaranteed completion date in the spring in advance of our first class coming in August. In terms of clinical opportunities, the students will spend the first 2 years, the preclinical part of their education, in Meridian, Idaho, and they'll spend the third and fourth year at clinical sites where they would actually be assigned for the entirety of their third and fourth year for all the rotations except for electives if they choose to leave the area.
So you're officially the first medical school in the state of Idaho. Tell me what kind of reception you've gotten from folks around the state because of that.
You know, it's so important for us to be here. Idaho, you know, as you just mentioned, we're the first medical school here. Idaho, before we came here, was the most populous state without a medical school of its own. And that's part of the reason why it currently ranks 50th in terms of primary care, 49th in terms of physicians per capita. And at first, you know, there was a lot of concern, does Idaho deserve to have a medical school of its own? Can it be done? And the support has incrementally grown literally month after month. And I can tell you today, we have more recognition of any new medical school coming into the area that I've ever seen.
So Washington State University, which opened its new medical school here in Spokane accepted students just from the state of Washington or students who had ties to the state of Washington. Do you have any sort of restrictions to that when it comes to who you're going to admit to your medical school?
We have a mission, and that mission is to train caring, competent physicians for Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, North Dakota, and South Dakota, and beyond. And so certainly we will take folks from outside the five-state region, but we certainly do want to put a focus, and we'll always have an in-state preference for Idahoans as well as folks from the other four states within the region.
And what are the sorts of things you try to find out from potential medical students, to find out whether they'll stay in your region, whether they'll go to rural areas, all the sorts of things that I think this medical school aspires to be?
So there's three determinants whether or not a person will actually end up practicing within a state. Number one is where they grew up, meaning the zip code where they graduated high school. And with having the preference in the state will affect that. Number two is where they go to medical school, not only for the preclinical time, but as well as the clinical time. And that's the reason why they'll be coming to Meridian for the clinical or the preclinical 2 years, and they'll be going to sites throughout the five-state region for the clinical years. And the third determinant is graduate medical education or residency programs after folks graduate. And physicians right now, osteopathic physicians that graduate from DO schools, over 99% of the time each year they get placed into residency programs. The challenge is, because we never had a medical school of our own, Idaho currently ranks 49th in terms of residency programs per capita. But we're making a difference. We have a seed fund for new residency programs within the target region. We've had some early success with that. You might have heard of Eastern Idaho Regional Medical Center. They actually just started taking applications for this coming year for internal medicine residents. Great Falls, Montana system called Benefits Health System, which is the second largest in the state. They actually just got approval from what's called the ACGME, which is the accreditation body, to be what's called a sponsoring institution. And that's, you know, part of the process for them to get ready for residents in the future. And so we're going to make an impact on that. So we're going to affect at least two, if not three, on most of our graduates or most of our students. So this is going to make a big impact in terms of, you know, practicing in, you know, rural communities and other communities within our five-state region.
It's Dr. Robert Hasty, the founding dean and chief academic officer at the Idaho College of Osteopathic Medicine. It's the Gem State's first medical school. It has just received permission to begin recruiting students to start class next fall. It expects an initial class of 150. Tis the season, and people celebrate it in different ways. Christmas, of course, is December 25th, the day Christians celebrate Christ's birth. Hanukkah is the Jewish holiday, celebrating the Maccabees' victory over the Greek army about 2,200 years ago. This year, Hanukkah begins at sunset December 12th and runs for 8 days. On Friday, some Buddhists around the world will celebrate Bodhi Day. It's the day on which Buddhists celebrate the man now known as the Buddha, as he gained enlightenment while sitting under a Bodhi tree. That was about 2,600 years ago. Some celebrate it in December, but because historically different cultures have lived by different calendars, others, such as Tupten Pelge, celebrate it on a day with a full moon in May.
That was the day celebrated as the day of Buddha's birth, a day of getting enlightened, and day of passing away. So all those three events occurred in the same month. So kind of triple auspicious day we celebrate.
Tupten Pelge is a monk and founder of the Buddhist Institute of Universal Compassion in northeast Spokane. He was born in Tibet in 1956. He was a young child when his family fled their country when the Chinese invaded. They made their way through the Himalayan mountains and settled, as the Dalai Lama did, in India. Later, Pelge worked with Buddhism's spiritual leader.
Yeah, I've been very fortunate. I had very close association with His Holiness. Not only as a teacher, but also I had the opportunity to serve in our government for many years.
That's the Tibetan Parliament in Exile, also based in India. In 2011, Pelge wanted a change, so he left politics and headed for the United States. He spent some time in California, and on a trip north to Canada, made a stop in Coeur d'Alene for a speaking engagement. There, he was asked to come to Spokane and speak at Gonzaga. He did a year later.
Gonzaga, being a Catholic university, inviting a Buddhist monk from out of blue was really very auspicious to me in my thinking. And when some of my colleagues came to me after the talk and asked me if I would consider come teach here, I said, why not? Some people started to follow me and my teachings, and that's how we started to have a little group.
That little group now attends teachings at his Buddhist Institute, which is based in an old house renovated last summer, not far from Rogers High School. Pelge's religious title is Venerable Geshe-la, which is roughly equivalent to calling a Catholic priest father. He's also a global scholar in residence at Eastern Washington University in Cheney, where he lives.
Buddhism is based on learning and rational common sense, rather than a faith system. It doesn't mean Buddhism does not have a faith and devotion, devotional rituals. We do, but that is not what Buddhism is based on. Buddhism is based on realistic, practical like with the karma causing conditions. You know, it is to follow your thoughts and actions, and understanding that your experience, good or bad, is based off of your thoughts and intentions and actions. There's no external power would dictate anything on you. It is you. You are your own refuge. You are your own enemy. I offer the precious mandala with my heart, speech, and body.
When Geshe-la Pelge chants and speaks with his followers, he dresses in his maroon and saffron robes. He sits on a cushion, legs crossed. Behind him on a chair sits a portrait of the Dalai Lama. In front of him is a laptop where he keeps his speaking notes. About 15 people are facing him. Some are sitting on pillows with legs crossed. A few sit on chairs. There's a mix of ages. Some are middle-aged or older, as well as a younger man with his daughter. To the monk's left are the colorful Tibetan prayer flags you sometimes see in pictures and mountaineering camps in the Himalayas. The heaters at the side of the room are working overtime to take off the chill. Later in his basement office, we resume our conversation.
So we think of monks as these beings who deny themselves material things, that, you know, they're very little things. I look at you at your desk, you have your laptop there, you've got your iPhone there. How has being American over the last 6 years affected who you are as a person?
Affects like, okay, yeah, we're living in the 21st century, right? Without this technology, there's almost no way to function, right? And if you are in service of humanity, if you want to try to make a difference, then you definitely are dependent on these technologies. We have been using all these gadgets back in India too.
I'm reminded of the bumper sticker that says, "What would Jesus do?" Mm-hmm. What would Buddha think about, do you think, the life that you live now?
We live in the 21st century, and whole world running after materialism. And that's where Buddha talked about attachment. He talked about Four Noble Truths, and within that Four Noble Truths, the attachment is the key point, how attachment causes all the problems. But, you know, that is why the attachment becomes very powerful, and that's where everybody run after materialism. With that stated, that materialism includes science and technology, come up with all these gadgets and tools. Now we are to the point that there's almost no way to function without these tools. Or if you really want to walk with the modern humanity, you are kind of really dependent on that, you know, to try to reach out people, try to kind of send your message to people. Science and technology is very much part of it. So from that point of view, I think even Jesus or Buddha or those holy beings would understand, and this is what it is with the time.
That's Venerable Geshe-la Thupten Pelge, a Buddhist monk, global scholar in residence at Eastern Washington University, and founder of Spokane's Buddhist Institute of Universal Compassion. Next week on Inland Journal, we'll talk about Hanukkah with a rabbi from Spokane's Temple Beth Shalom. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's weekly public affairs program. You can hear it on the radio or via podcast. On the air, it's heard Thursdays at noon on KPBX and at 5 p.m. on KSFC. You can hear podcasts of our programs or the individual segments online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to our Inland Journal page. Listener support allows us to produce and air this program. We thank you for your contributions. I'm Doug Nadvornik.